Would you please be seated again so we can begin? I think we need to request a sequel. Amen. Our third speaker this afternoon is Orfelia Ortega. Yes. Yeah. Sí. For many years in Cuba, the women who studied theology or Christian education became the secretary of the pastor. Not just in Cuba. When they began to work after finishing their studies. During her theological studies, Ophelia made a serious decision. She would never learn to type. When she arrived to her studies, her first job after her studies, the pastor asked, "Wonderful. It's very good that you will be here to work with us. Of course, you know how to type." "No, sir, I don't." "What? What do they teach in this seminary?" "Oh," replied Ophelia, "I learned many things, but not to type." The pastor responded, "Then I need to send you to preach in some of the mission fields." And Ophelia replied, "That's a wonderful idea. I'm ready to do that." Please welcome with me Orfelia Ortega.
My first thought when I received the main subject of my presentation today was a question: why me? Why do I need to address the conference on the issue of the church as worshiping community? Is it because I am a pastor? I began then to wonder about myself as a liturgical pastor. And I am definite not that. I enjoy some liturgies that we women prepare together for events such as the pre-assembly meetings of the World Council of Churches, the women's seminars at Voce Ecumenical Institute, regional women's events like this. I very much like the liturgy of some ecumenical gatherings, especially when they include music and litanies from different confessions and cultures. The Latin American regional events, the Caribbean events, with liturgies that use our contextual rhythms and meaningful symbols. And what else? I do not much enjoy the traditional worship of my Reformed tradition. On the contrary, I suffer it. In my country, Cuba, we are very proud of our African heritage and African ancestors. We are a mulatto culture. And then we always said, the black man, woman, sees everything. He's her joy, he's her suffering, he's her love, and he's her hate. He's her revenge, and he's her despair, even he's her slavery. Yes, we are people that we like to sing. And then it was precisely in the liturgy that the foreign influence has been most deeply felt in our church life. It was really a transculturation of the liturgy that ignored the idiosyncrasy of the Cuban people. They ignore completely our joy and lively spirit. our search for color and rhythm, the constant body expression, the rhythmical movement of the hands, the waist, and the hips. But we were really immobilized because of the colonial pattern in a dry, rigid, verbalistic, non-participatory liturgy. We were called to silence as a symbol of reverence in worship, while laughter and words and dance and music and movement was going outside of the church. Then the second question that I asked myself was, if I am the least capable person to speak about liturgy due to my past painful experiences in dealing with it because of the colonial experience, could I imagine or reimagine the worshiping community? And my third question that I asked myself was, what is the meaning of imagination in the context of the worshiping community? Then during my presentation, my point of reference will always be, because this is at the core of my life, that the church is a community called to transformation, personal, ecclesial, and social transformation. And this is the core of my ministry. If I am not working for that, I am not working for anything else. Called to change, to transformation. Then if we believe them, that, then liturgy will play an important role in unfolding and shaping our imagination. But we realize that it is impossible to imagine or reimagine without listening to others. Already it has been mentioned. In other words, listening to other stories of suffering and joy. Last month, I participated in an event linked with the Ecumenical Decade of the Churches in Solidarity with Women, organized by the Conference of Manitoba and Northwestern in Winnipeg, Canada. They are there. The theme was Windows 93. We're listening to several stories that open windows for each of us about the reality of Aboriginal women in Canada, lesbian pastors, and women farmers. Three different realities with a common denominator: tears and pain, exclusion and discrimination. We understood immediately that it was impossible for us to even imagine their situation without hearing their stories. It was Margaret Mary Kelleher who helped me to understand that knowledge depends greatly on imagination. And of course, imagination is definite link with memory. We need to look back to recover the dangerous memory that not only challenges and opens our imagination, but opens possibilities for hope into the future. This is what we learn in the Feast of the Hebrew people. The memory of the Exodus was the beginning of their life of worship as a communitarian expression of liberty. We need to affirm too that imagination plays a critical role in the process of making decisions. When we're listening to the life stories of the women in Winnipeg, Canada, we ask ourselves, and now that we know this, is there anything that we could do about it? If so, what? Then the process is always linked with our call for transformation. Furthermore, it is very clear that liturgy could act as a sensor own imagination. If we use male imaginer of God in our liturgy, this sets limits for the imagination. Or if we mention our memory with the historical support of the data offered by the authoritarian, oppressive, dominant patriarchal system, or if we ignore that the process of knowing or understanding is based not only on hearing, but on seeing, tasting, touching, smelling, feeling, embracing. In other words, real imagination. If we don't take all this in consideration, all these elements, then our vision will be very limited, partial, sexist, racist, classist, and cannot bring any joy or hope for the future. The Bible gives many vivid images of life, faith, and hope. Let us explore together some that could open for us some imaginative windows for the building up of the church as a worshiping community. And I will mention three biblical images. The first one is, the title that I gave is Reimagining Life in Times of Death. Reimagining life in times of death. And I call it a spirituality of resistance. It was a time of crisis. There had been famine for 3 years and a great feeling of despair because it had not rained for a long time. The King David was worried. What should be done in the present situation? A dialogue with God gave him some of the insights of the dramatic effects of a scarcity and drought. According to Yahweh, they have done wrong during the rule of Saul. A massacre of the Gibeonites brought division, hatred, and enmity among them. And of course, the negotiations began. David called the Gibeonites and spoke to them. It was a male elitist negotiation. And as frequently happens, even in our times, is we see now the situation in the ex-Yugoslavia, in Burundi, in Haiti, in Somalia, in Angola, and we could go on, they decided to fight. This male elitist negotiation decided to fight. This is a very familiar story. Those who need to build peace, harmony, to care for people, are now ready to massacre again. They selected 2 sons of Rizpah, sons of Saul, and 5 sons of Merah, daughter of Saul. The story is cruel and despotic. It is the first day of the harvest, time of community work, time to return to the Mother Earth, to collect the fruits of human work. On this same day of the beginning of the harvest, they kill. And then I close my eyes and I could imagine and see her. She is standing in the middle of the field. She's going to keep a long vigil, a spiritual ritual of resistance. She, the violated concubine of 2 Samuel chapter 3, verses 21, challenge in this very moment the power of men and the strategies of war. Rizpah took a sad cloth and spread it on a rock for herself from the beginning of harvest until rain fell in them from the heavens. She did not allow the birds of the earth to come on the bodies by day or the wild animals by night. In 2 Samuel chapter 2, Rizpah is presented as a passive victim, raped and considered an object of barter. Here, her very presence is eloquent. We could imagine her. She was invisible there. Here, her art is an act of covering, protecting the bodies. And it was so impressive and notorious that even David, who represent power and authority, could not ignore her. She really changed the course of history. I close my eyes and I also imagine the women who sustained her. It's not in the biblical passage, but we could imagine that. They were coming during the whole season with food, water, clothes, prayers. It was a women's vigil. Night and day, she was there. And in so doing, she was challenging the king, the logic of the leadership of men. In the name of national security, it was more important for them to keep an alliance of death than to bring a concrete act of repentance, forgiveness, and life acceptance. And maybe we are already asking ourselves, was it really worthwhile? Why she did? They were dead already. Nevertheless, it is important to know that for the Hebrew people, life only exists in relation with others. The possibility of being cut off from her people was a terrible threat to the Israelites. Furthermore, even physical death could not happen in isolation. As a member of a community, the person dying was linked with her people, or her parents. Mutilation and forgetting were the worst humiliation for the victims and a terrible malediction. Loss of memory is always accompanied by a loss of identity. And we need to affirm that. Rizpah tried to keep alive the memory of her children there in the desert, day by day, in the cool nights and in the terrible sunshine, supporting the odor of the bodies. Rizpah resisted. Her act was a political one, but it was an act of deep spirituality, both together. This must be a fundamental part of our liturgy, to maintain the memory of the victims alive. Amen. This was what our dear Hin Kyun Chun did in her liturgical presentation in Canberra, the Assembly of the World Council of Churches that was so very much criticized, but she there keep the memory of the victims alive. This is what the surviving Korean comfort women are doing today, keeping the memory of the dead alive, the victims. This is what the widows of the Chilean martyrs are doing today. This is what the black and indigenous people are doing today. And maybe this is what the German people, in the middle of the cruel xenophobia that is permeating their society, need to do. Maybe the whole Europe. To keep alive the memory of the victim of Hitler's regime. Rizpah was not only crying as a mother for her children. She had the firm intention of restoring human dignity to the 7 victims. Confronting the genocide, she intended to be human in the midst of the terrible dehumanization of her time. And this is what the liturgy needs to be. To be human. To be human in the middle of all the dehumanization that we have today in the world. Liturgy needs to be like that. Then, the attitude of Rizpah toward the victims illustrates the power that arises from those who have a real commitment to others. And the final part is very interesting. Because, all the patriarchal reading and so on, sometimes what we have been listening, the interpretation. According to the text, the incident of Rizpah began with hunger and drought. The intention is to resolve the problem of starvation and drought. Nevertheless, the rain came only when RISPA action was acknowledged by the leaders of the nation. Only at this moment, God heeded supplications for the land. Only when they recognized what she was doing. Then the question for us today is, where do we find this spirituality of resistance in our world? Do we find it in our traditional historical churches? I don't know. Do we find it in the life of some local congregations? Do we find it in the life of the base communities? In the women's churches? In the metropolitan church? In this precious and symbolic world of the popular religion of the people that sometimes we forget completely? In the Pentecostal churches? In the black churches in the U.S., in the practice of African traditional religion, that some of us even we don't know what is going on in African traditional religion. Last May, we organized in the Ecumenical Institute in Boston, where I am working, a seminar on popular religion and evangelism. We gathered together people from the Pentecostal churches, indigenous communities from the north and the south, black churches in the U.S., and people from the so-called historical churches. Working with them during 10 days, I found that we were entering into the field of the sacred and existential, involving deep life experiences, difficult to understand because it is in a space to be lived and not to be discerned with our rational thought that could be dichotomic and dominating. It was a space of the sacred thing. We learned about the spirituality of resistance of female religiosity in Brazil, always linked to the base necessities of life, service to others, and the healing of physical and spiritual injuries. In 1992, the first Brazilian ecumenical encounter of women pastors happened, 1992. And then we realized, when we heard the testimonies of the people, that 99% of the women pastors were involved in alternative pastoral ministries in which practical activity was required for the renewal of life. Even systematic theological reflection done by women in Latin America today has these characteristics. Almost all these women are involved in what we call historical projects. This means some of them are working with street children, with prostitutes, whatever. We heard about the work of women who distance themselves from these models and from the institutionalized areas of religion and carry on their work, which is of great significance for the community, in a simple way, which is worth nothing. We listen, for example, and we heard about the bendecidoras, the blessing women in Brazil, and the rezadoras, the praying women. Much loved figures who spend their life healing the wounds of the people or individuals who have sometimes been disillusioned by conventional medicine, or again have been unable to gain access to it. These are women's houses, the houses of the rezadoras and the bendecidoras, blessing women, praying women, where many people are healed of their physical and spiritual life, and then spiritual ills. It is in receiving the love, tears, prayers, and blessing of these women that men and women go back to their houses and families with their life renewed and ready to continue with their labors. A healing spirituality sometimes unknown, completely unknown by the traditional churches. We listen to the stories of resistance of many Pentecostal communities where the poor can find a group of equals, where the newcomer is normally welcome, accepted, valued, and understood. where he, she is incorporated into the collective rituals of the community, where he, she can sing aloud without risking provoking laughter or negative comments of neighbors, relatives or friends, where he, she can share a collective prayer while praying alone during the service. The totality of such an experience makes possible a healing action of the community over the newcomer and provides the condition for the affirmation of a new identity and incorporation into a new culture. We heard again of the great spiritual resistance among the black churches in the U.S. I don't need to comment because you know better than me. When they are no longer nobody but somebody there in the congregation. No longer objects in the propagation of faith in service of the marketplace, but the subject of truly gospel-centered evangelization for the living or more abundant life in solidarity with each other and in service of God's coming reign. We're listening to the stories of the indigenous people in Alaska, Mexico, India, Bolivia. And especially we heard the story of a painful reality for the poor rural communities in Mexico, where the Virgin of Guadalupe, that has always been a symbol of strength and support for the poorest, is now far away from them. Her place is becoming more and more a tourist place where people need to pay to develop their devotional life. But as an spiritual of resistance, they told us that new virgins are appearing to the poor in the south of Mexico. And then they change. Now the poor are going to the south in pilgrimage, creating, and all the symbols are very important in the popular religion, creating new symbols when those that belong to them have been co-opted by the institution and the market process of society. Yeah. Then we need to ask ourselves, is really in our spirituality of resistance we need to do like the poor, creating new symbols and not the symbol that has been co-opted by the institution or by this market process of society. And symbolic expressions are fundamental for the poor people of the world and the marginalized people. Nevertheless, and this is, I want to tell you that because this is important. After all this experience, that it was we were really in a sacred space. We could not believe the stories that we were listening from them, from the very indigenous people. At the end of our seminar, it was difficult for the indigenous people to incorporate their tradition into the final Eucharistic service. The worship committee that was led by a man did not fully understand their symbols and the new content that they are giving to them. For example, the use of oil, incense, different way of making offerings, and so on. And then it was such a discussion about the Eucharistic service. And then the whole experience of the seminar was spoiled at the end because we could not understand the symbols of the poor. People coming from traditional religion, traditional historical churches there. And then I remember Vicenta Mamani from Bolivia with her little hat here and her pollera, the dress, she stand up and said, well, the true gospel from now on, she said to us, should not be in contradiction with the cultural and religious values of our people, because the gospel is respect, love, peace, justice, truth, koinonia, and salvation for all human beings according to the indigenous tradition of the Aymara people in Bolivia. Look at that. Love, peace, justice, truth, koinonia, this means community, salvation for all human beings. And then she said, Vicenta, could it be possible for us to accept the fact that it's not necessary to stop being Aymara in order to be a Christian, or to stop being Christian in order to continue to be Aymara? Woo. This means this is what we need. We coming from the historical churches. There is a complete vast universe or symbolical expressions in the popular religion of the people that we don't know. We ignore completely. We don't know. And then God is them, acting through them. I want to be brief at the end. Well, it's not much to say. But I don't want to miss the second and the third image briefly. The second image for me is reimagine a communitarian meal in times of hunger. Reimagining a communitarian meal in times of hunger. And I call this the spirituality of solidarity. And I want to interpret with you very briefly, because we want to have time for the question, the biblical image of the Eucharistic service that is present in 1 Corinthians 11, 70 to 29. Let us imagine the scene. A scene. But when I am tired, the English is not passing. Then I hope that you will understand me. It was a very special moment. It was a time of recovering the memory, and it was a time of celebration of hope in this Eucharistic scene. Recovering the memory and celebration of hope. But the rich arrive early. They have enough free time to do that. They brought their own meal that was abundant and very special. The poor arrive late. They were not independent workers, but employees and slaves. Then they arrive late. They were very subject to a rigid schedule. It was difficult for the poor to find places to sit. The best places and the best meals were already distributed. Not only the rich ate first, but ate better. It was a scandal, as many of our celebrations sometimes are a scandal. These divisions there, and we need to say this today, the division there were not doctrinal or theological, but were social and economic. It is not the deadly sins of gluttony and drunkenness that was condemned in this passage, but the selfish indifference of each person and family to the needs and situation of the deprived and the poor. Then the words of the institutions were used by Paul, showing the style, the meaning, and the spirit in which we need to celebrate the Holy Communion. And then, of course, he used a very well-known part of liturgy and tradition. When Christ is giving himself body, blood, the rich Corinthians were living for themselves. When Christ broke his body in pieces for the sake of humankind, the rich Corinthians kept their entire meal for themselves. Jesus shared the bread, took bread, gave thanks, broke it. Yet, it is in his memory that we need to share the bread and the blood of our life. Then Paul, for me, is not referring to a particular liturgical moment of the Lord's Supper. He's confronting us with our daily life. We cannot see the two events, the common meal and the Lord's Supper, as two separate moments. They belong together. For this reason, for me, to eat the bread and to drink the cup in an unworthy manner is definitely linked with the practice of sharing and with our daily life in community. When we drink the cup and eat the bread and we are not committed to do something for transformation, then we are eating in an unworthy manner. Nothing to do with liturgy. Then the basis of this communitarian meal that is the Eucharistic is rooted in a deep experience of sharing. If we are not ready to do that, it's better not to go to the Holy Communion. The Reverend Jean-Bertrand Aristide, President of Haiti, addressed the world with this moving message that I want to share with you today. He said, "I can imagine a Haiti where at 3 or 4 in the afternoon, every person sits down and has a great big steaming hot plate of rice and beans. That will be a peaceful country. The rich of my country, a tiny percentage of our population, sit at a vast table covered in white damask and overflowing with good food, while the rest of my countrymen and countrywomen are crowded under that table, hunched over in the dirt and starving. And Aristides said, that is the crime of which I stand accused, preaching food for all men and women. Then, the problem of the table, Eucharistic table, is a difficult one. Because some are sitting at the table and others are under it. The sharing of the bread in the Eucharistic ceremony calls us to a collective conversion, as it has been expressed very often, our bread needs to be God's bread. I mean, it's always in plural. And the last image, reimagine hope in times of hopelessness, the spirituality of hope. I will share with you a common conversation in a base community. Dear Maria Jose, do you read the Bible? Yes, sir. I read it daily. Which part of the Bible do you like best? What I most like is the book of Revelation. Do you understand when you read it? No, I don't understand it. My knowledge is very poor, but I like it very much. It brings me comfort and courage to go into the daily life struggle. Many people in Latin America are saying this today. They prefer Revelation than they prefer the gospel now. They read much more often Revelation than Matthew or Mark or Luke or John, because it's more meaningful for them now. Then this image of hope is what I want to share with you, because this is the image of the poor people of the world, the image of Revelation. And it's very interesting that the image for me in this liturgical book, because the book of Revelation is a liturgical book, have a woman as one of the central part of it. There are three dramatic persons, especially in chapter 12 and 13. The woman, the dragon, and the child. The woman here stands symbolically for the people of God, for the messianic community. And I like the image. Her relation with the creation is evident. If you look at the passage, she is clothed with the sun, with the moon under her feet, and on her head a crown of 12 stars. This means the images of women is there presented in connection with creation. Deep connection with creation. And they are very powerful images in these passages. The dragon is the power of evil. Evil, whatever. Which creates chaos and destruction. The dragon cannot deliver new life. There are many dragons in the world today. His power is destructive, representing the murderous brutality of despotic power, suppressing any challenge to their rule. And then the women fled into the wilderness, into the desert. The desert is the place of the people of God to escape, to hide, to survive. Remember the story of Hagar, nourished and sustained by God. Yes, the woman was nourished for 1,260 days. God was on her side. In the middle of the desert, in time of crisis, God nourished the people in different ways. We remember how the early church went underground. They met in little rooms and small rooms, praying, reading the scripture, sharing bread and wine in a new kind of worshiping community. That form of resistance is beyond the grasp of the dragon. This means the dragon cannot go into this kind of community of resistance. Cannot, has not entered, cannot enter in. Here the women scurry on eagle wings. Then a new image appears, that of engulfing water, symbol of the threat of death, but the earth came to the help of the women. Then we have again that creation supports the covenant. Again, it's women and creation together. The earth, in the sense of creation, is not the ally of the dragon. The earth serves God's purpose, Mother Earth. Then the earth came to help the women. It opened its mouths and swallowed the river that the dragon had poured from his mouth. Again, the whole connection between women and creation. And in chapter 13 and 14, there are two types of worship. It's very interesting. Those to worship the powers of death, and those who refuse to worship the bed and suffer the consequence of their refusal to adjust witnesses to the name of the Lamb. They represent the excluded from buying and selling, but they are the first of humankind to be brought free, and the only ones that could hear the liturgy from heaven, the new song about God's purpose with creation and human history. Oh, it's wonderful, this liturgy. This means there are some people that could listen and other people that cannot listen, that cannot hear this liturgy from heaven. This new song that God's purpose are singing to us. Then they sing the song of victory over the forces of chaos and death. It is the son of the powerless when they have escaped from the powerful. And this liturgy conducts us to work for a radical change, a new heaven and a new earth. And the newness of the new heaven and earth is that of total transformation of this old world which God loves so much. In chapter 21st and 22nd, we find several images of the book of life, the book of life, the water of life, the tree of life. And this is not a single tree of life. The eschatological city contains many trees, 12 kinds of fruits, 12 times a year, and all its citizens have free access to them for their healing, because they never will undergo suffering, sickness, or there. Tears will be no more, only when death will be no more. Then we have the right to cry. Because only when death will be no more, then tears will be no more. Then God now will wipe away every tear. And the message at the end is clear. Worship God. Worship God. But which God? The God of life. And only then our liturgy can be acceptable. We are called in the reimagining of this worshiping community to an spirituality of resistance, a spirituality of solidarity, and a spirituality of hope. Thank you.
Thank you. We have about 4 minutes if people... They were good, weren't they? Yes.